From Tennessee to Wyoming, New York to Texas, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the Supreme Court of the United States returned to session the first Monday in October, and a number of major cases will now be decided. Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation is here with details. President Trump continues his efforts to reduce the regulatory burden on American businesses with two new executive orders. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The left contends that capitalism, profit motive, is destroying America and harming individuals. But a new report from Ian Murray of the Competitive Enterprise Institute found that is not true. He talks with Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine. And not only has the nation lost its ability for civil discussion on public policy, but common courtesy also is a thing of the past. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, talks about it on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Abortion, immigration, sex discrimination, all are hot-button issues that will be decided by the Supreme Court of the United States, which began its new term this past week. Elizabeth Slattery is here to talk about those cases. She is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth, welcome to American Radio Journal. Elizabeth, the Supreme Court of the United States is back in session. Before we get into some of the major cases that are before the court this session, please explain for our audience a bit about how the court operates. What is the significance of this first Monday in October?
Sure. Well, thanks so much for having me. The justices hear arguments from October through the end of April, and during that time, they will periodically issue opinions. The first opinion of the term typically doesn't come until sometime after Thanksgiving, and they wrap up with opinions by the end of June. Then they all get out of Dodge for the rest of their summer vacation.
Here we are in October, and the court began hearing cases this past week. A couple of interesting ones. One that could have a profound impact on individual rights on employment practices. There's a case before the court, actually, I believe several cases, involving discrimination based on sexual orientation. What is the issue here before the court?
There are actually three cases. Two of them involve sexual orientation, and the third involves gender identity. And the core issue is whether the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which created Title VII, which bars discrimination based on sex in employment, whether that includes sexual orientation and gender identity. Now, of course, in 1964, when Congress passed that law, sex meant male or female. And the law, of course, was intended to help women and women's equality as they were entering the workforce. But the issue before the court is, does that cover more than just male and female? And that was an issue the justices really wrestled with at the oral argument this past week.
Is this also beyond the cases that are directly in front of them, Elizabeth? Is this also come down to a constitutional question of the role of the courts and the legislature? By that, I mean, if the definition of sex is to be expanded, wouldn't that be something that the legislature, the Congress, would need to do rather than have it be a court interpretation?
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And this was something that came up a number of times throughout the argument. Justice Sam Alito asked about, are we the right branch of government to undertake this sort of big policy change? Chief Justice John Roberts also asked questions along this line, pointing out that there were a number of states that had expanded their own employment discrimination statutes to cover additional protected classes, including sexual orientation and gender identity. So the issue is, if these states were expanding their own laws, why would that have been necessary if sex already covered sexual orientation and gender identity?
With the seating over the last couple of years of two new justices, for the first time this term, we are going to see a major case involving abortion rights come before the Supreme Court with those justices on the bench. What is afoot there? What case is before the court? What issue? And when is the court likely to hear those arguments?
This case is June Medical Services versus Gee. It comes out of Louisiana, and it involves the state passing a law that would require doctors who perform abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. Now, if this sounds familiar, that's because the Supreme Court heard an admitting privileges case out of Texas back in 2016. This was the term when Justice Scalia passed away, and the case was heard and decided after he had passed away. And the more liberal justices on the court, along with Justice Kennedy, struck down the Texas law. Now, the Louisiana law is potentially an opportunity to perhaps overrule that Texas case. So we'll see what happens there. Earlier this year, a majority of the court, Chief Justice along with the traditionally liberal justices, granted a stay of the lower court ruling in this case to the challengers, so it would prevent the law from going into effect for the time being. So that was a pretty good indication the justices wanted to take the case up on the merits, and in fact they did. Just a couple of weeks ago they announced they would be adding it to this term. We don't know yet when the oral argument will be. They've scheduled arguments through December, so at the earliest it would be sometime in January.
Immigration is obviously a huge issue nationwide. The president has put it front and center. He's taken a number of actions that have resulted in court cases. The Supreme Court's going to wade into the immigration controversy this coming term. What's at stake there?
The court has agreed to hear a case looking at the Trump administration's decision to roll back the DACA program. This was the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that was put into place in 2012 by President Obama. And this was the program that would give deferred deportation and allow individuals to apply for work authorizations. And it extended to an estimated, I think, 800,000 illegal aliens who came to the country as children. So the Trump administration announced that they would be rolling that program back, and that rollback decision has been challenged in court. So that's the issue that's going to the Supreme Court this term.
As I mentioned earlier, we have two new justices, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, who are on the court at the same time for a full term this year. As we look at the cases that are before us, are these cases, Elizabeth, likely to give us some insight into whether, in fact, Kavanaugh and Gorsuch will be part of the so-called conservative or constitutional wing of the court? Or, as we've seen many times in the past, sometimes justices who everybody think is going to be part of that wing end up not being so much, including Chief Justice Roberts. So are we looking at some of these cases as bellwethers for those two?
Certainly the abortion case could potentially be a bellwether for what kind of justices Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh will be. Of course, it's hard to draw any broad predictions about what they might be like 20 years from now, 30 years from now on the court, because, of course, justices tend to serve for many decades these days. So it is early days, but looking at their records on the appeals courts, where they both served for more than a decade, they are both committed to interpreting the laws according to their text and interpreting constitutional provisions according to their original public meaning. So I think they will be both firmly within the what we call the conservative branch of the court.
We have been talking with Elizabeth Slattery, who is a legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about Heritage Foundation. Also, give us a web address where folks can go. You've written extensively on this and other topics. Where can folks go to read those writings?
You can find things on heritage.org, and the Heritage Foundation is a conservative public policy organization in Washington. We come up with policy solutions and suggest them to Congress and the President, and we also follow whatever's happening at the Supreme Court.
Elizabeth Slattery of the Heritage Foundation. Elizabeth, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, and there's been a number of critical moves this past week in terms of deregulation. We're going to talk about that. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back. Thanks.
President Trump has issued a couple of executive orders, this to advance his deregulation agenda. So, Scott, tell us what the president did this week.
Going back to the beginning of the administration, President Trump has worked with his administration to significantly reduce and eliminate burdensome regulations that are stifling job creation, innovation, and entrepreneurship. And I think in doing so, his policies have really accommodated the economic boom that we're seeing, which reduced unemployment, is boosting wages for all workers, and really ushering in a new economic environment that's generated over 6 million new jobs. This week, President Trump brought a renewed focus to what we call regulatory dark matter. And this is a thing that's been coined by the Competitive Enterprise Institute. They always have an annual report called the 10,000 Commandments, and they try to total the cost of regulation on the U.S. economy. And so one of the things that's really difficult to analyze when you're doing cost-benefit analysis of regulations that have been promulgated by the executive branch is the regulatory guidance that's associated with the regulation. And too often, this regulatory guidance enables bureaucratic abuse. So what the president did, the first executive order is called Bringing Guidance Out of Darkness, and the second one is Transparency and Fairness. And what these executive orders are going to do is they're going to stop those unaccountable government agencies that are hindering Americans with excessive guidance documents from attacking the American people with unexpected and unfair penalties for so-called noncompliance. Now, the issue here is that when they're issuing the guidance, it doesn't always have to be published in the Federal Register, and it's not always sent out to the parties that it affects. So some folks don't even realize that they're not in compliance with these guidance documents associated with major regulations. Now, the executive orders that he signed this week are going to help the bottom of the economic ladder the most, because you got to think about the Americans that don't have sort of the army of compliance lawyers or the resources to merely fight back against the powerful government bureaucrats. And these are the individuals that are the small businesses and really the economic engine that differentiates between an economy that I think can support 3% economic GDP growth and a struggling economy that we saw during the years of Barack Obama, when really excessive promulgations of regulation was coming forward and we had 10% unemployment. So really what this is going to do is it's going to increase transparency dramatically by requiring guidance to be posted online and on the Federal Register.
We, of course, will continue to keep an eye as the president works to try to reduce the nation's regulatory burden. Now, let's shift gears a bit here, Scott. There's been a controversy developed this past week involving the NBA, the National Basketball Association, which apparently has a large presence in China. And the controversy centers around the fact that they appear to be buckling under Chinese pressure relative to Hong Kong. So fill us in a bit on that.
Obviously, what's been happening with China and Hong Kong has really got a lot of attention here in the American press. You've got Chinese that are going after Hong Kong's ability to demonstrate and to really have free speech. So this is fundamentally communism against democracy. And more recently, what happened is the Houston Rockets general manager, Daryl Morey, came out with a tweet that said that he stood with the free people of Hong Kong. And he was basically forced to apologize, and the NBA was on a basic apologetic tour of his statement to the Chinese, because this is such a touchy issue in China that the Chinese said that they were going to cancel their relationship and the way that they broadcast the Houston Rockets games. There's over a billion people in China, and they have hundreds of millions of consumers of the National Basketball Association. And so these comments made by the Houston Rockets general manager really hurt the feelings, I want to say, of the Chinese. NBA stars that have been really socially active on American politics, like Steph Curry and LeBron James, coaches like Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich, they've all basically said that they need to study the history related to this situation and that they're not ready to comment. And what we had this week, we even had the Los Angeles Lakers and the Brooklyn Nets playing on October 10th in China. And the Chinese prevented all the American players from speaking to the media before or after that game. Now, this is a clear infringement on our rights. Obviously, you've also got these players that are outside of our country, but we expect to have a free and open press. We expect our players to be able to express their political opinions, their social opinions, the way that they feel, and to use NBA as a platform. Obviously, LeBron James has done this a lot over the last several years as he's emerged into a world superstar. But really, the China-Hong Kong situation, we're heading into the regular season here shortly, and we saw fans being escorted out of Philadelphia. We saw signs being removed from fans that were protesting in Washington, D.C. And really, the NBA is headed into a difficult situation that certainly could have an economic impact in the months ahead via sports in China and the United States.
And of course, we'll continue to keep an eye on what appears to be yet another double standard by the left. We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a couple of words about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We have over 250,000 members. And if your listeners are interested, they can check us out on our website at clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Contrary to claims by the left, capitalism is not only not hurting democracy, capitalism allows democracy to flourish. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine discusses a new report from Ian Murray of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Eric?
There's this strain of thought that's emerging, or really has already emerged on the left, and in some ways is emerging on the right, too, that makes the argument that capitalism and democracy are somehow incompatible with one another. And like I say, you hear this more on the left. You hear this from the Elizabeth Warren and the Bernie Sanders types who want to control every choice that most Americans make about their daily lives, including where you get your health care and what video games you buy or how many deodorants are available in Walmart. But it's a trend that is emerging, I think, dangerously on the right as well. And it's something that we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Ian Murray. He is a senior fellow and a vice president over at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. That's a free market think tank right here in Washington, D.C. And he's the co-author of a new report that looks at exactly this issue, the intersection of capitalism and democracy, and makes the argument for why these two things really, not only are they not incompatible, but rather they actually need one another to coexist and to work the best that they can. Ian, we always appreciate having you out here on the show. You've been here several times before. Thanks for making some time for us today.
It's always a pleasure, Eric.
The pleasure is all ours, Ian, as usual. Critics increasingly say, and mostly on the left, but some on the right as well, say that capitalism is kind of undermining democracy. Should we believe them? Are they onto something?
Well, I think what the critics are saying is that over the past 30, 40 years, free market reforms have been undermining democracy in the sense that we've gotten rid of old laws, which they saw as an exercise of democratic power in restraining what they thought was this unfettered beast of the free market that could hurt people if it was allowed to run free. The thing is that they should recognize that we don't live in an unconstrained democracy. We don't get to vote on everything. We don't get to vote on which church we go to, for instance. You know? And that's because we live in a society that recognizes rights. And my contention is that economic freedom is one of those rights, and that what we've seen over the past 30 or 40 years is a recognition that economic freedom as a right ought to be respected.
One of the things, Ian, when we hear this argument on the left in particular, and I think this is the left is more given to sort of making this mistake, but I think they tend to mistake capitalism for corporatism, for the interests of big business, when, of course, libertarians like you and I would say that capitalism is really, it's free markets. It's not favoring big businesses just because they're big. Sometimes the government does do that, of course, but that's kind of the critique that the left levels. I think they make that mistake. Is that a fair conclusion on my part that I'm drawing there?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that the left did over the first half of the last century was that it constrained the corporation by making it the delivery vessel for a lot of the reforms that they put in place. You know, pay-as-you-go taxation, the delivery of certain benefits to employers, to employees. Healthcare became completely linked with the employment contract. And as people have decided that they want to get free of that employment contract and other things, that link has begun to break down. So it's the corporations which are getting the blame, when in fact it's the left has been using the corporation for the past 100 years or so.
We are talking with Ian Murray. He is a senior fellow and vice president at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, talking about a new report on the intersection of capitalism and democracy. And Ian, one thing that you get into in the paper here is this idea of a second constitution that the left has built up. And this is largely within the regulatory state. It's largely within things like the National Labor Relations Board, those types of entities. Just real quickly for our listeners, what is this second constitution and how does it differ from the first or if you like, the only constitution that we had?
Well, the originalist construction was based around negative rights, the idea that the government cannot make you do something. You know, it cannot force you to go to a certain church. It cannot force you not to say something. It cannot force you to give up your right to bear arms. The second constitution, which is based around what legal scholars call super statutes, these laws that have taken on the sort of enormous constitutional validity, like the National Labor Relations Act. You know, there are signs that the Dodd-Frank Act is heading that way, and they're the ones that empower the regulatory state. And they're based around positive rights, that government has guarantees to you that certain things will be done. As we were talking earlier, specifically in terms of your relations with your employer, for instance. And that's a very different way of thinking from the original constitutional framing of negative rights.
I want to bring this back around to capitalism, because that's where we started this discussion. And only about a minute left here, so we have to be kind of quick. But this idea that everything should be settled democratically bothers me sometimes, because that all sounds fine and good until maybe you're in the minority. And if you have freedom, if certainly in a market, you don't have to do what everybody else is doing. You can do something different. You can do something that's unpopular. Sometimes that doesn't work out, but sometimes that's actually how great ideas come about, is by not being driven by the majority.
Well, that's absolutely the case. I mean, I view free enterprise as economic democracy in action. You know, we choose where our money goes. When you constrain those economic choices, we're reducing that democratic choice at the same time.
Obviously, big picture ideas here, big ideas. Folks, if you want to get more into this discussion and this debate, you can check out CEI's new report, Democratic Capitalism, Why Political and Economic Freedom Need Each Other. You can find that at CEI.org. Ian Murray, our guest today, is a co-author of that report. He's also a senior fellow and vice president at CEI. Ian, thanks for taking some time and joining us.
Thanks so much, Eric.
And again, check out Ian's work and everything else that they're working on over there at CEI at CEI.org. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our defenses of capitalism and democracy every day at Reason.com, and catch me right back here again next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Along with the growing inability of those in the political process to have civil discussion and debate on key policy issues, politeness and common courtesy also are on the decline. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
In 2014, I walked across the United States to raise awareness of the needs of children with emotional and behavioral problems and developmental disabilities. I wrote a book about my journey called Life Lessons Learned, Amazing Stories of My Walk Across America for Children. I wrote of my journey because I was stunned by the overwhelming generosity and kindness of the people I met along the way. I mentioned that in the 147 days of my walk that I did not have one negative experience. What has changed in the last 5 years has stunned me. Since 2014, I have never seen such an appalling change in a nation's character. The nature of civil discourse has sunk to new lows. Perhaps it was always like this, but my walk heightened my perception of the problem. When I discuss this concern with different people whom I've met in my new role as a legislator, many people noticed the change in civil discourse, but usually chose to blame that change on others. Even Judge Gorsuch indicated the severity of the civil discourse problem. I'm not sure about anyone else, but I can guarantee you that I am responsible for my own conduct. Blaming this issue on another person is absolutely irresponsible. It fails to take into consideration that you are responsible for yourself and your own behavior. The nature of dialogue changed my mind when people started to feel marginalized and condemned because of their faith, their locality, or other labels others chose to attribute to them. The dehumanization of others within society contributes to this feeling of detachment from the comments made about others. Recently, I proposed a very controversial bill in the legislature to keep the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania out of bankruptcy. The reaction from some to a potential solution to the problem that has existed for centuries was predictable, but I was stunned by the tone and absolute abject disrespect that people had for one another in the dialogue. I noticed a generational divide. The feedback that I received from both young and old alike was surprising in the level of disrespect that one generation had for another. The level of civil discourse deteriorated to new lows that I would never have dreamed imaginable in my lifetime. Comments made by people of my age group about the younger generation and vice versa showed absolute contempt for one another. Generational divides are not new. That divide has existed since time began. What is new is the public vehicle and form in which people are willing to memorialize for all time in social media their contempt for one another. When I hear a school shooting, I cannot help but wonder if the nature of discourse on social media is not fueling this lack of respect we have for one another. Almost a complete detachment from reality. I used to think our financial problems were the biggest crisis facing our nation, but now I'm convinced that the biggest crisis is our loss of a moral compass. This lack of respect does not just stop with social media. Recently, I was coming out of a restaurant and held the door open for two other persons. They both walked in and never bothered to acknowledge the courtesy of having the door open for them. Seeing this type of behavior much more frequently from people of all ages, I decided to do an experiment. In the experiment, I decided to track the next 100 encounters I had in which a common courtesy was extended to someone to see what the results would be. The results were astonishing. While the results are definitely not scientific, when I shared my comments with friends and coworkers, I was stunned by the stories I had heard about their experiences. I thought I'd share some of them with you. Greeting a waiter, waitress, or checkout person with a good morning or the like before they greet you to see what would happen. I was amazed when I did it, the expression of gratitude from servers who frequently felt ignored by the customer. You ought to try it and see what happens. Holding the door open for someone of any age. The number of people who just walked through without any comment exceeded 50% consistently, regardless where I have done it. When someone asked me how I was doing, I would say that I'm doing fine and then immediately asked how they were doing. The reaction to my question was priceless. Usually I would get a comment like, well, that's the first time that's happened this week, or I certainly didn't expect that. And from that moment on, the conversation changed for the better. Quite candidly, unless we collectively decide we're going to change, this civil discourse will never improve. The problem begins and ends with you and me. When a society loses its sense of community, the eventual breakdown of civil liberties and freedoms will eventually occur. Cultures which lose their identity will soon perish. Even George Washington noticed this problem. He wrote a book called, and I quote, Rules of Civility and Decent Behavior, and unquote. He outlined 110 rules of civility. The first one was, and I quote, every action done in company ought to be with some sign of respect to those that are present, unquote. Perhaps we should all take a lesson from our first president. Thank you for your time, and thank you for listening. Be kind to one another. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country. They include KKIM-AM and KXKS-AM in Albuquerque, New Mexico, along with KERI-AM in Bakersfield, California. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.